On Thursday, July 25th, we got a bit of perspective on the recent Robert Mueller hearings in Congress from Professor Alan Sanders at St. Peter's University in New Jersey. He's a former reporter for Time magazine as well. And Chris Powell, a columnist for the Manchester Journal-Inquirer, joined us later in the show to talk about whether or not state aid is really doing anything for the futures of Bridgeport, New Haven, and Hartford. And hi there, we are at 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Paul here on this side of the glass, Aaron on the other side of the glass. It is Connecticut today for a gorgeous-looking day out there. Thursday, heading into the weekend, 78 degrees in Bridgeport, right? Put this one in the frame. We'll keep this one. Lot of people morning quarterbacking, Thursday morning quarterbacking, if you will. What went on for a few hours yesterday in Washington? Robert Mueller comes out. Half the country says, oh man, he was devastating. The other half of the country says the guy could hardly keep us awake. Well, let's see what Professor Alan Sanders has to say. Professor Sanders, an associate professor of political science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey, former Time magazine reporter. Professor, hi, how you been?
Very good, Paul. How are you?
I'm all right. Well, I'm sure you soaked in as much of that as we all did yesterday. What were your thoughts after they wrapped up yesterday?
Well, my thoughts are kind of mixed. That is to say, I do share the view that the special counsel, Mr. Mueller, was not very impressive. He seemed halting. He seemed off balance. He didn't seem to be in full control of the facts and knowledge of what was in the report. So I think that was surely disappointing. But he was true to form in being laconic and monosyllabic in his responses. Mm-hmm. And given that reputation and the fact that he did that, I do think that the Democrats achieved their objective. That is to say, everybody, certainly the Democrats, and most of all the media, would have loved a great soundbite from Mr. Mueller, but he doesn't operate that way, and I think the Democrats anticipated that. So they went through a litany of questions, factual questions, in which he answered yes, no, yes, no. And if you followed that exchange, it was quite devastating, quite damning regarding the president and his behavior. And I suspect they planned that. It looked like they planned that, and they probably expect to make some campaign messages and slogans out of it going into the 2020 election. So I think they did as best as they could, given the fact that the person they were dealing with was not going to be very helpful to them.
Yeah, and they knew that, Professor, going in. And I had another legal expert on from the area yesterday around here who said prosecutors, federal prosecutors, special counsels, they don't like to do that type of thing. Their job is to appear nonpartisan and submit the report and have at it and then go fishing for a couple of weeks, right?
That's right, and I think he did play that role, and I think they anticipated that. I mean, if you take a look at the first set of questions, they hoped that he would come in with some sort of summary statement during the questioning period that would be, from the Democrats' point of view, at least very helpful and damning to the president. But he didn't do that. So as the questioning progressed, you got all kinds of, you know, pretty factual questions, and I don't have the exact quotes here, but, you know, I wrote down a couple of things that I remember. You know, he was asked by various members of the committee, was the president totally exonerated by the report? No. Mm-hmm. Did Russia interfere in the 2016 elections? Yes, mm-hmm. Systematically. Was the interference aimed to support Donald Trump's elections? Yes. Now, if you play that back in a proper sequence in a commercial or on social media, although the special prosecutor didn't say it explicitly in his own words, the exchange does look pretty bad for the president.
Professor Alan Sanders is the guest, associate professor, St. Peter's University in New Jersey, political science. And now, Professor, we see kind of as the dust settles, at least for now, from the hearing yesterday, a story just broke before I came on the air. Again, Nancy Pelosi seems to be trying to quell the impeachment rumbling. Now, whether she's sincere about this or just trying to play den mother, she still has a tough job on her hands.
Yes, she does, and she knew that as she sought re-election to the speakership. But I think what's interesting is looking at her and also looking at Mitch McConnell. Both are pros, real pros at the work they do. Of course, they disagree fundamentally on policy, but they both look at the long game. Mm-hmm. They don't really get sidetracked on short-term issues unless they really have to and they're overwhelming. But they're looking at the long game, and the long game is all about achieving power and maintaining power. And so Nancy Pelosi, like Mitch McConnell, has been looking really at the 2020 elections. What can we do, or what can each of them do, to either expand their majority or obtain a majority if they don't have one? And I think that's what drives her. It's what drives Mitch McConnell. And it's through the lenses through which she sees everything. So I think she knew, or at least she expected, that Mueller's hearing yesterday would not be the definitive event that many people anticipated. And that's why she quelled impeachment proceedings or processes before the hearing. And now seeing that the hearing was what she pretty much expected, she is again playing for the long game. And of course, the planning, as I said, was a whole set of questions that would ultimately portray an administration that is corrupt. And as Chairman Schiff said, and he used some very strong language, he called the president disloyal. The long game is really to portray an administration that is incompetent, out of touch, and deeply damaging to the country.
Professor, is there a chance, because of course you, was what you and I well know, that things happen, things settle with the electorate, right? Perception is reality in the media, in politics. Any chance that because of Mr. Mueller's performance yesterday, because it's who he is, he was very subdued, he was very quiet, didn't want to give that fiery answer. Any way this snowballs back perhaps on the Democrats, or maybe in some districts where you maybe had people on the fence who, you know, don't really listen to the minutia of this, but say, hey, look, if it was bad enough, they'd impeach him. What do you think of that?
Oh, yeah, sure. And I think the Republicans are doing their best to capitalize on that perception. Certainly in the questioning, they attacked the integrity of the special prosecutor and the processes that he used. He pushed back, but in my view, he didn't really push back as forcefully as he could have or should have. When you look at a lot of the Republicans' questions, additionally, they asked about all kinds of events and activities that weren't investigated. I'm not sure how that resonates with the general public, but certainly with certain parts of the base, they're very familiar with these allegations that, other people and other events related to the Democrats should have been investigated. So, sure, they will seek to capitalize on it as well with their base. I do think, however, that the yes-no interchange with the special counsel Mueller resonates probably better with those who are either on the fence about Trump and certainly the Democratic base, because they dealt with some very specific and clear-to-understand questions. And so I think on that score, if the Democrats choose to capitalize on it, and that's a big if, because it's not clear that the Democrats will use smart strategy going into the 2020 elections.
And again, they'll see what their polling says, right? What all their consultants say. Absolutely, yeah.
Right. So it's all about framing questions or making arguments that are easily understandable. I think the special counsel gave that opening to the Democrats, less so, I think, to the Republicans. But again, it's a matter of how smart each side is and how up to speed they are on the latest technologies and social media and campaign commercials to make the most of it. But I think the whole episode is really a 2020 exercise rather than an impeachment exercise.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, because it's a 2020 exercise. And you know what I've been saying here, Professor? I've been saying, well, listen, if we are so confused, right, that the Russians are doing what they can on social media, Twitter, Facebook, my point, a part of my monologue yesterday was, all right, both sides admit it, both sides are outraged. I think a good portion of the American people, Professor, are going to say, okay, then what are you going to do about it? What can we do technologically about this? How do you stop this? And the answer, I would think, is not all that easy.
No, it's not all that easy, but the parties need to look like they are doing something.
Look like it.
It goes back to your statement, perception, right? And one of the interesting things is that the Democrats in the Senate pounced immediately on this and introduced various legislation. Some had already been passed by the House. Some was introduced in the Senate for the first time by some members of the Democratic Party there. And they introduced bills. And what was interesting, of course, is that Mitch McConnell immediately stifled these Democratic attempts at passing legislation that would ostensibly increase election security. Mm-hmm. So already I think you can see that the Democrats are trying to start to capitalize in some way on the Mueller testimony, and I'm sure they're going to try to hit the Republicans over the head about, look, you had the special counsel testify about how serious this is, how constant it is, and how dangerous it is to our system, and you're twiddling your thumbs, Mitch McConnell and the Republicans. And so that's already telling us that we're heading into the 2020 campaign and that election security, as well as all the other elements that were brought up yesterday, will be part of the 2020 campaign.
How effective, Professor, and the guest is Professor Alan Sanders of Jersey City, New Jersey's St. Peter's University. How effective, Professor, do you think it would be for whomever becomes the Democratic nominee saying, you know what, they said, Director Mueller said that, yes, the president could possibly be indicted for crimes after he's out of office. Well, if you elect me president, I'm going to do that. Do you think that would have any sort of impact, or would a candidate go there in the general election?
No, because that's dangerous. You don't know how large your electoral mandate is going to be. If a Democratic a candidate won overwhelmingly, then he might feel safe to do that upon assuming the presidency. If the election was close and a Democrat won by a close election, he or she might be preoccupied by bringing the country together. So it's hard to tell what would happen. I've always been sort of skeptical of the notion that the president is above the law. I don't think so. I mean, I think he should be above the law, certainly.
No.
But the way the presidency is treated, impeachment should be a fairly routine process. If a president is incompetent, if a president is corrupt, if a president is pursuing terrible policies, of course, politically, he should be held accountable during his term. But, of course, we don't treat impeachment that way. And then we've got this OLC opinion, which is, by the way, only an opinion of the executive branch. I'm not quite sure why we should give it so much respect, because it's a self-interested opinion. But that opinion says you can't indict a sitting president.
Because it would paralyze the government, is what they say. Yeah.
Well, I mean, a lot of things paralyze the government, like, partisan gridlock. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they should be in anymore, really. If a president has committed wrongdoing, it should paralyze the government.
No, you're right. No, and we saw with the Nixon, it worked during Nixon. Professor, one final question, if I can get you on this, because chances are we won't talk between now and then. Next week at this time, we will have been going over the second Democratic debate, the two debate nights in Detroit. Look into your crystal ball, if you can, for a minute or so. What do you think are we looking at in the second set of debates?
Well, I think two things. First, we have Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren occupying the same lane, and I think for the first time actually debating on the same stage. So we need to see how that comes out, which one comes out ahead, which one gets a bump in the polls and in popular support. Then, of course, we have the continuing controversy between Vice President Biden, former Vice President Biden, and Kamala Harris, and so we need to see whether her successful debate performance was just a temporary flash in the pan, so to speak, or whether it really has some heft behind it and whether the vice president is on the defensive.
Professor Alan Sanders, St. Peter's University, Jersey City, New Jersey. Professor, always good to talk to you, and we will connect down the line. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure, Paul. You take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye. He says, quote, despite spending ever more money from both their own tax bases and the states, the cities are poorer and more dysfunctional, incompetent, and corrupt than ever. And their demographics are so desperate that they are hardly capable of self-government, lacking enough of a politically engaged and independent middle class to fend off the government and welfare classes, whose own furious political engagement guarantees their incomes. Those words written by columnist Chris Powell, the former managing editor of the Manchester Journal-Enquirer, who's still writing for them. Chris, Paul here. How are you, sir?
Hey, good. Thanks, Paul. Good to be with you.
Boy, Chris, do me a favor. Next time you write stuff, don't pull any punches, okay? just come right out and say it. But, I read your piece and I started thinking, and I'm approaching 60 now. And so I remember over the past 40 years when, money started flowing into New Haven, where I grew up, and Bridgeport and Hartford. And I thought that you had a kind of a unique thought here, that what's all this actually accomplishing?
Yeah, I'm getting up there in age too, Paul, and I actually remember a time when Hartford was better off than it is today. That there was a day you know, Bridgeport and New Haven, too. But I was prompted to write by a series of stories that have been produced by seven Connecticut news organizations lately, something they call the Cities Project, about how to restore Connecticut cities, different ideas. The bigger ideas, it seemed to me, were just various mechanisms of throwing more money at the cities. And I thought, you know, wait a minute, this is what we've been doing for many, many decades, certainly at least since the Horton versus Meskel decision of the state Supreme Court in 1977, which prompted state government to start throwing a lot of money into new money into the city school systems. And now we're at the point where state government is basically reimbursing half or more of the budgets of the bigger cities. And you know, what have we got? We've got only more poverty and less education and less efficient government. And every year, the solutions being offered to us are just, you know, spend more money on what hasn't worked. And I just thought we ought to question our policy premises here, at least in regard to the most expensive policies, which I think are education and welfare and urban policy and drug criminalization, and really audit them for results before we start putting more money into what obviously hasn't been working.
Chris, in this column, you also talked about, and I watched the video myself, a video made by one of our contributors here at WICC, of course, Lenny Grimaldi. He's on a regular basis with us with the blog Only in Bridgeport. And you caught that video as being a real metaphor of what you're talking about here.
Yeah, Lenny got this video from, I guess, some people who were promoting a redevelopment project for downtown Bridgeport that's kind of stalled out right now. It was about a 15-minute video of the Greater Bridgeport Symphony Orchestra playing a, what I thought was a fairly ethereal classical music composition in the old Palace Theater, which is closed and abandoned in downtown Bridgeport. And the video very artfully contrasted the orchestra's brilliant performance with the you know, shabbiness of the abandoned theater, the crumbling walls and ceilings. And I just thought that was really a metaphor for our cities in Connecticut. You know, your own call letters, WICC, they stand for Industrial Capital of Connecticut. Bridgeport used to be that. You know, today, Bridgeport's a very troubled city, just like Hartford and New Haven. But here in the video, you had a magnificent symphony orchestra with Bridgeport in its name. I'm sure it doesn't get half the attention and respect that it deserves, and it shows you that there's still a lot of talent and potential around here, but I just don't think that there's the civic virtue that we need to restore the state and particularly restore the cities, because 90% of our government's efforts now just go into making sure that the government employee unions are happy with their salaries and their pensions. In fact, the only services that state government guarantees to be successes are the services involving the compensation of government employees. The salaries and the pensions, thanks to binding arbitration and collective bargaining laws for government employee unions, they take priority over everything else in government. The government employees in Connecticut, the only ones who get a contract from the government that, you know, can't be violated. The rest of us just have to take what we're given. And, you know, what we're given in many respects is not working, is not serving the public. And yet, here was this video that Lenny posted, called attention to, that showed there's, you know, still some greatness around here, and there's still enormous potential around here, but it will never be realized unless we recover enough civic virtue to examine our policy premises and decide that, you know, no, the compensation of government employees is not going to come first anymore.
When you use the term or the words, Chris, civic virtue, what are you exactly pointing to?
I'm talking about civic engagement, public mm-hmm. public engagement in our public life, in our government. Voter participation in Connecticut, as throughout the country, has been declining for half a century. My newspaper did some research a few years ago, and we calculated that in some towns, 20 to 25% of the eligible adult population is not even registering to vote. And when the Secretary of the State reports after an election that, say 50% of the people voted, what she means is that 50% of the maybe 70% of the eligible adult population voted. So the real voter participation is substantially less than what the Secretary of State announces. People are not engaged in public life as much as they used to be. And as a result of this disengagement, the government is forfeited to those interests that are on the payroll. And that is why I argue that the government employee class and the welfare class are basically determining policy in Connecticut now, because the public has opted out. And that's the formula for disaster.
An old friend of mine in New York, Chris, a gentleman who, a real City Hall hawk, went back to like the Abe Beam and John Lindsay days all the way up through the first term of Rudy Giuliani. He used to tell me, he used to say, Paul, you know why government is inherently inefficient? I would say, why, Don? He goes, it's pretty simple. He goes, nobody owns it. and I think of that now, Chris, when you mentioned the civic virtue, is that I don't think we have, in many areas, maybe not all, but especially in some areas here in Connecticut, there's no either teaching of or yearning a desire to own the situation of what we're in or the future of what we can do.
Yeah, that's true, Paul, and it just reminds me, I think 15, 20 years ago, I got invited to speak to a journalism seminar at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. When I got there, the journalism professors told me that they lately had found their aspiring journalism majors so ignorant that they could not identify the three branches of government. And so, as a result, the journalism department established its own civics course as a prerequisite for journalism majors. And I began thinking, how do you get out of a high school in Connecticut without knowing what the three branches of government are? And how do you get into something calling itself a university without knowing? Well, I know how this happens, because social promotion now is our only uniform educational policy in Connecticut. Nobody is held back anymore. Every kid knows in Connecticut's public schools that he doesn't have to learn a damn thing. He will be promoted from grade to grade and then given a high school diploma and then very possibly even admitted into something calling itself a public university, where two-thirds of the students are taking remedial high school classes. Now, that is not the formula for an informed, engaged citizenry.
And especially, Chris, when we have, and look at what just happened with either the town committees meeting in Hartford, Bridgeport, and New Haven, and there are going to be some primary challenges likely in all three cities, but then you have the old machine politics, Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, and you couple that with what you just talked about, and trying to really carve out something for the future is made all the more tough.
I think 5 or 10 years ago, the Connecticut Post did a story about the Bridgeport Democratic Town Committee and found that something like three-quarters of its members were city employees or, the spouses or close relatives of city employees. They have the absolute right to participate in government, and I'm just pointing out that the people who are on the payroll are the people increasingly dominating the government, because they're a greater share of the participants in our public life than, you know, the private sector is. And that is one reason why the only priority government in Connecticut has is taking care of its own employees.
So, Chris, you know, these municipalities are really between a rock and a hard place. As you say, there's a politically disengaged electorate in that city. And then fiscally and financially, I mean, what do they do? You know, I think, frankly, you know, a shot in the arm for Bridgeport would be, at least for jobs and money, to get some sort of a casino here. But then again, Chris, I saw something the other day which bothered me. You know, you see these cities trying to reinvent themselves and get reinvigorated. And in New Haven, Hartford, and Bridgeport, they have all these new renovated apartments and all this new housing, and they're really nice places to live. The problem is nobody in the city now living there can afford it. I mean, you have these astronomical rents, which nobody who you're trying to get to can really afford.
Well, you know, that's the urban problem in Connecticut is one of demographics. The cities just have too many poor people and not enough middle-class people. Now, you know, I'm not arguing for, you know, driving the poor people out of town. I am arguing for examining our poverty policy to find out why it is not producing self-sufficiency and prosperity, why it's producing instead generational dependence. It's perpetuating poverty. Now, certainly housing in you know, downtown areas is a great idea for reviving the cities. I mean, Hartford destroyed itself by knocking down all its downtown housing. New Haven survives in large part because there's a lot of people living upstairs from, you know, its shops and offices downtown. And New Haven is a real city. So I certainly applaud the cities that are trying to increase housing downtown. But I think the real problem for the cities is demographics. We have concentrated the poor in Connecticut into the cities. In fact, I think that is the, and as a public policy matter, that has been the main objective and result of policy in Connecticut for 50 years, has been to lock the poor out of the suburbs and to have them in concentration camps in the cities. And you cannot run a prosperous democratic city with people who are all poor.
And I remember talking, Chris, with somebody a couple, 3 years ago from the children's charity here in Connecticut. And one thing the gentleman said to me, he said the quickest accelerant for poverty and people getting locked into poverty and affecting kids and getting into the cycle that you mentioned, Chris, is a lack of middle class, blue collar, those $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year jobs that people can go to in their cities and keep cities a vibrant place. But with the tax policy and other policies of the state, those sort of manufacturers, you know, Chris, they're either cozy in the suburbs now or they're down in Carolina somewhere.
Yeah, well, our taxes are too high, and they are too high, first because we have public employee labor policy that makes those costs impossible to control, and secondly because our major education and welfare and urban policies are, and economic development policies and drug policies are so counterproductive. They don't do what they are nominally supposed to do. We really have got to reconsider the premises of these expensive policies, and until we do, I don't think we're going to, you know, fix the cities or the state.
And you and I will both bow our heads to the guy who sits in the governor's office now and say, enjoy, you wanted this, right?
Yeah, well, look,
he's trying.
He needs to be pushed in the right direction, the whole government does, but that's got to come from the people.
Yep. Chris Powell, the title of the essay, More Money for Cities, It Has Failed for 40 Years, currently online, journalinquirer.com. Chris, continue writing the great stuff. We appreciate it. We'll talk down the line. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. There you go. Check it out, folks. He is one of the most articulate voices in the state. He doesn't pull punches. And what he says is true. It's a vicious cycle here in these cities, and I don't see the way out unless there is more, as he says, civic involvement, civic education. You need people to challenge people. Doesn't mean you have to get violent about it, but you need civic engagement and challenging of policies on local level, state level, and national level.